Hello there, how are you? Welcome to Breakfast All Day. Twice in 1 week. We had Oscar nomination talk on Tuesday. Today is a Thursday with normal reviews.
Yes.
Oh gosh, it's January.
Ooh, it's January-ing very hard out
It is,
there.
And I'm Christy.
I'm Alonzo.
Hello, good to see you guys and hear you and hear ourselves and all that. So we've only got a couple of reviews for you. There's a lot of movies opening, but most of them are really terrible, so we're just going to focus on a couple here for you and also play a little bit of catch-up with True Detective.
Yes.
We have episodes 2 and 3. So I would love to start with Serenity, if we could.
Ooh, boy.
I've got to work through this with you. I'm in the midst of reviewing it for RogerEbert.com, and we're going to try really hard not to spoil anything for you.
No, this will be a spoiler-free review, although this is the kind of movie where Dave White would say, it's not a spoiler, it's a selling point.
Yeah.
But we'll still be coy about it.
Can I describe it? Can I try?
All right.
So Matthew McConaughey is the captain of a fishing boat,
mm-hmm.
a commercial, for hire fishing boat on this tiny idyllic island called Plymouth. It's beautiful. It's magnificent. It's impossibly quaint and scenic. And he is this tormented, chain-smoking, hard-drinking, constantly sweaty and frantic and sad fishing boat captain with the unlikely name of Baker Dill. Baker Dill. And so this is like a pulpy neo-noir about this guy who is a fishing boat captain who is damaged, who has a past.
Mm-hmm.
He had been an Iraq war veteran. He is seeking the solitude of this island.
Right.
Jaimin Hunsu is his first mate. And one day, a blast from the past in the form of, I guess it's his ex-wife. His ex-wife,
or at least the woman with whom he had a child.
Right, Anne Hathaway comes sauntering in through the door of the only bar that exists on all of Plymouth. And she's smoky-eyed, and she's the uber femme fatale here, and she's got a proposition for him.
Mm.
She is now miserably married. The person that she left Matthew McConaughey for, Jason Clarke, is this very wealthy and kind of like, he's got to be some kind of underworld figure. It's sort of shady and shadowy.
He's monstrous, whatever
yes.
he is.
And yeah. he's really horrifically physically and verbally abusive to her. So she's wealthy beyond her wildest dreams, but she's miserable because this guy is horrible. And she presents to Baker Dill this proposition: take him out of your boat, take him fishing, get him drunk, push him overboard, let the sharks eat him.
Right.
And it does not necessarily go down that way.
Yeah. She basically comes to him with the offer that every film noir starts with,
right.
which is kill my husband.
Right. The damaged, the beautiful woman.
Yeah. You know, from out of the past to body heat, they basically sort of like, there's a certain formula we're hewing to here. I mean, okay, kill a husband and out of the past, but
yes.
you know what I mean. You know what I
yes.
mean.
So Jason Clarke is a horrible guy. And then eventually Jason Clarke does show up on the island
and is indeed horrible
and does indeed go out of the boat. And so there's a lot of like ethical back and forth here with Matthew McConaughey's character as far as what do? Do I take the money? Do I do this? But then there's also what seems to be like a psychic or a supernatural connection with the son
yes.
that Matthew McConaughey and Anne Hathaway had, who is back home in Miami, I want to say.
They never say where home is.
No, there's some references to Miami. Like,
is there? I think that's where Diane Lane's son was in Miami.
Oh, right. But the notion that like things are wild there, and here on Plymouth it's pure
right,
and simple.
Right.
And so there's a son who we cut back and forth to. And that's all I'm going to say.
Yeah. This movie is written and directed by Stephen Knight, who made one of our favorite films of the last decade, Locke.
Absolute favorite films.
Which is, people might argue, a gimmicky movie in that it stars Tom Hardy as someone who spends the entire movie driving an SUV and having conversations on the phone. And it is still dramatically riveting. And there are other voices, including, I want to say, Olivia Colman, right?
She's one of the voices on the phone.
Yeah, on the phone. Mm-hmm. But so this movie is also gimmicky, but in a terrible way. Because when the gimmick happens, you're like, oh, that's a stupid gimmick.
Right. And there's a partial reveal of what the gimmick is about halfway through.
Oh, no, there's a partial reveal what the gimmick is in the very opening shot of the movie.
Yeah, well, once you go back and think about it.
No. The moment that
you
happened.
You think you know.
Oh,
okay.
Oh, I knew exactly. Here's the thing. The opening shot of the movie tells you what the gimmick is, but you're thinking, oh, it can't be that. No. And then you find out later, oh, yes, that's it.
It is that. And a lot of times with a big plot twist like this, it can be a lot of fun to then go back and try to play catch up and try to put the pieces together
that
and look
whole,
for clues.
What? Bruce Willis was dead?
Right. But don't tell anybody. And so that part can be fun. But what happens here, once the ultimate massive plot twist is revealed by the end, is it really raises a lot more questions than it answers.
Oh, yeah.
And the questions are icky.
Oh, yeah. No, it's very uncomfortable. And it's also the kind of movie that tries to get away with the idea of you thought this movie was just dumb, but no, this is all because of a reason. And it's like, yeah, but the reason's also dumb, you know? So, like, they basically try to explain away why this seemed like a very trite film noir and why X, Y, and Z. And yeah, it cannot write a check to cover that.
Right. So the fact that it's dumb tries to explain how bad it is, but that's not necessarily, it's not like a, oh wow, that's really exciting kind of thing. It's baffling. So yeah, so Stephen Knight also wrote what, Eastern Promises? Uh-huh.
And Dirty Pretty Things.
Right.
But then he also wrote like The 1,000-Mile Journey and...
A 100-foot journey?
100-foot journey, yes, sorry.
Is it the thing where they cross the street to eat Indian food?
Yes, that one. I think he also wrote Burnt.
Oh, the Bradley Cooper is a chef
movie.
Thing.
Yeah, so he's got a very mixed record. But hey, he invented Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, so...
Did he?
Oh, yeah. That was his original claim to fame. So he can, like, make movies or not make movies or live on Plymouth Island for the rest of his life, and he didn't care.
Well, he should have phoned a friend here. Because this was not good. Having said that, though, it is batshit crazy enough that it must be experienced. Like, it's so insane. I would put it in that rare category that you and I enjoy so much, along with, like, Collateral Beauty and The Book of Henry.
So awful.
Like,
it's awesome.
Up there. Awful, but, like, a specific brand of awful. Like, crazy awful.
I mean, maybe not, like, pay money and see it in a theater awful, but definitely, like, stream it with friends and cocktails, because you are just kind of, like, slack-jawed. I mean, just for all the moments of, like... Matthew McConaughey sort of posing and making the kind of furrowed brow faces that he makes in those Lincoln commercials and literally yelling at the sky. He does that a bunch. If you ever wanted to see his ass, boy, plenty of that in this film.
There is so much McConaughey ass.
Yeah.
It's true. Also, you get some really terrible sex scenes and banter with Diane Lane.
Oh, I felt so bad for her.
Poor Diane Lane. Like, she is stuck in this one room, this very shadowy room. She's like... hot to trot divorcee or something on the island who, Matthew McConaughey goes to her when he needs money and he sleeps with her. He's basically like her personal man whore.
Yeah.
And she's saddled with like really awful, like sexy repartee with him.
Yeah.
She gets to leave that room exactly once. I felt so bad. She spent a lot of time like peering through the slats in her shutters.
Oh, right. Yes. And it's like, and because she's Diane Lane and is better than this, like, you know, most of what she does in the movie is has sex with Matthew McConaughey, but she does it with like a wrap on.
Right.
Like she has some sort of like silky robe, even though it's super muggy and hot and everyone's constantly sweating.
Yes.
You know?
So we have, I feel like Anne Hathaway and Diane Lane are the only ones who really understand what is happening here.
This is like a cast you feel bad for. Because like McConaughey, it's weird how he went from like irritating to like awesome and now he's kind of irritating again.
Yeah.
But you know, he, Hathaway, Diane Lane, I mean, Jaimin Hansu, who is like saddled with this sort of like Zakes Mokai role. That is an actor who used to get stuck with these sort of like roles of people who were mainly there to give advice to white people and sort of maybe be in tune with nature, you know.
He's borderline magical.
Yeah, that's annoying. I mean, Jason Clarke, I'm not a big fan of, but even he deserves better.
He's very over the top. And again, by the end, you come to understand why these characters are this way, why the whole thing is so arch, why it feels like a parody of a film noir in a lot of ways. But even then, that puts you into a whole other weird mindset when you find out what's really happening. Anyway, the less said, the better about that. But I almost want to recommend this. I'm very on the fence.
I'm an eventual recommend. Like, don't see it this weekend, but later when it pops up on streaming or cable or whatever, you know, and you're in the right mood, like, oh, we got to see this thing.
Yeah, it's kind of pretty, though. The scenery is kind of pretty.
I mean, it is, you know, it. I don't know where they shot it, but it's,
It looks Caribbean-ish.
It looks like a travel commercial, you know.
Yes, lots of overhead shots of, like, the boat in this, like, glittering blue water with various sharks, various highly symbolic sharks swimming around. And anyway, it's dumb. I had fun. So my number is a 2.8.
Yeah, I said 3, you know, for Anne Hathaway pulls off being a blonde better than you think she might. You know.
And her wardrobe is kind of cool. It's all, like, big, wide-brimmed hats with, like, you know, ribbons and scarves around them. She gets to wear, like, sexy, classic island resort wear.
Yeah, it's very the Kathleen Turner collection.
It is. So our number is a 2.9. Is it 21% on the tomato meter right now. So, yeah.
I mean, it's bad, but it's at least bonkers bad and not boring bad.
Oh, no, it's never boring. Yeah. It's exciting all the time, whether it should be or not. Oh, it's also, there's a guy who is following Matthew McConaughey around the island in a suit with glasses and like a little briefcase. And
I have to give a shout out to Bibbs. He reviewed this for The Wrap and he compared that guy to a character in Catalina Caper, which is a deep cut, but a totally correct one.
I don't even know what that is.
This is a terrible 60s movie they did on Mystery Science Theater once. And there's literally a character, like everybody else is cavorting on the beach and he's constantly in a suit having like slapstick pratfall. So this character is totally that. It's weird.
All right. So yeah, Serenity. Ooh. Hoo boy, is it January. However, the movie we're about to talk about is a lot better than I think you would expect from this time of year.
And this title.
Right. It's called The Kid Who Would Be King. Alonzo, please tell us about it.
Sure. So it's about a young boy who is bullied in school and being raised by a single mom. While running from those bullies, he winds up on a construction site where he sees a sword in a stone, and he pulls it out, and wouldn't you know it, it's that sword and that stone, and he is the new bearer of Excalibur, which means that Merlin shows up as a somewhat whacked-out teenager occasionally, and then occasionally he's Patrick Stewart. Merlin prepares this kid for the return of the sorceress Morgana, played by Rebecca Ferguson, who wants to basically subsume all of the UK into darkness and chaos. And it's better than you would think. It's directed, it's written and directed by Joe Cornish, who did Attack the Block,
which was
a great movie. It's funny. This is the week of, you know, new movies from people who made earlier films that we really loved. I think this movie is better if you think about it as, it's a much better spin on the Arthurian legend than Guy Ritchie's King Arthur was.
Oh, God, yes.
Better to think of it that way than to think of it as the new from Attack the Block. Because it's not quite as good as Attack the Block, but it has a lot of that same energy and unpredictability and, you know, unlikely heroes, I guess.
Yeah, this reminded me of some 80s kids movies that had real stakes and real danger to them, like Time Bandits.
Yeah.
Or like The Goonies.
I've heard a lot of Goonies comparisons.
Right, in that you have kids who are in legitimately perilous situations.
Right.
And it's scary. I mean, and there are monsters, and the film never condescends and never coddles them. Like, they have to be resourceful. They've got to figure things out for themselves and work together as a team. And there's kind of a joyous kid energy about that, but also it's not safe. Like, there's something kind of scary about it in a way that we don't see very often in kids movies anymore, but we did during a certain era of the 1980s.
And I like the fact that, like, you know, for example, the bullies wind up having to become part of his sort of new Knights of the Round Table. And at first you think, wow, that was a quick conversion, but no, it turns out it's going to take a while for them to stop being jerks.
Right. It's in their DNA still.
Exactly. Yeah. And so there's this, you know, they have to sort of fail before they can succeed. I think it felt a little long, like in terms of there's a lot of steps to go through to get to the big sort of, you know, CG finale. Mm-hmm. But, you know, overall I was entertained by it. And I think who plays Merlin, that kid's amazing.
I don't know.
Oh, well, sorry.
I got to look them up. But if I look them up, let's see if I can do it on my laptop while we're doing this.
My phone is in use for the YouTube thing.
Let me see if I can
not
figure this
out. Not having it written
down
in front of me.
Hold on. I'm bad. I'm bad about these things. But let's make sure I'm still recording while we're doing this, because sometimes...
Yeah, I know. It's
oh, we're still talking. Hooray. Yay. Congrats. Technology. As you guys may have noticed, technology is elusive and challenging to us sometimes.
We didn't grow up with smartphones, so we're not as magical as a lot of y'all are.
Young Merlin's a guy named Angus Emery.
Okay.
And he's got a really cool kind of like... twitchy, squirrely energy about him, but he's also the smartest person in the room at all times, and so he's like frustrated with them for being mortal.
Yes.
And messing up and not getting things right, and he becomes an owl. Like, he'll sneeze and become an owl, and then he'll sneeze and become Patrick Stewart again.
And they figure out a fun way for him to get like these sort of weird elements like beaver blood or whatever that keep him young, that he manages to find in an unlikely place. So
I
enjoyed it.
It does a good job of blending the magical with the realistic, right? Because the settings do feel very much like modern day, you know, urban homes and kids and schools, and it feels like that makes it feel accessible. But then there are like legitimate big CGI things. Louis Ashburn Circus, we should say, is the young kid who becomes the king. He is son of Andy Circus. Mm-hmm. He previously did the voice. If you guys saw that motion capture Mowgli that Andy Serkis directed, Louis Ashburn Circus is the voice of one of the cute young, oh God, what is
the
he?
Wolves,
is he a cub? Is he a wolf? I guess, yeah, he's like a wolf cub. Are they cubs? Are they pups? When they're babies,
whatever.
Tadpoles.
Little baby wolf.
He's the voice of that. And he's got kind of a likable scruffiness about him.
Yeah, like I was having a conversation with somebody where they thought that, oh, he's the kind of kid that you cast as the sidekick. And that's sort of what I liked about the casting of him, is that he is not like this, you know, model, you know, like magazine layout child, you know, who is also the chosen one. Like, he is this very sort of regular, relatable kid. And the movie, I think, also says a lot about how, you know, heroism isn't about lineage, and it's not about, ancestry. It's just about individual, you know, excellence or whatever. And so somebody was saying it felt like a direct jab at all the people who were insisting on knowing, like, you know, who Rey's parents were in the new Star Wars movies.
Oh.
It's like, who cares? Like, that's not, you know, it's not the thing that necessarily has to get passed down through the bloodline. It can just be that someone is exceptional. You know?
Right. And then, but along those lines, there are some, like, legitimate emotional stakes as far as
his own
understanding who he is and what his family is. Also, Dean Chamu is the name of the young man who is Louis Ashburn Circus's best friend,
yeah,
who is kind of like schlubby and nerdy and like sweetly awkward, but he has his own moments to shine here and there. So it's a nice crew of actors that maybe you don't really know, maybe you had never seen before, and that gives it an authenticity as far as being able to, you know, jump into this world with them and feel like they are actual kids going on an adventure. So.
Yes, and Rebecca Ferguson, you know, of course, is wonderfully villainous.
Yes.
You know, she's not afraid to go big on this one.
Yes. I would say, though, if you have little kids and you're thinking about bringing them, there are some kind of frightening images. They frequently have to run from and fight off these entire, like, cavalcades of flaming skeletons on horseback.
Yes, this is true.
Wearing armor and swords, and, like, they're on fire, and they're quite relentless. And then what happens with Rebecca Ferguson's character might be a little scary, too, in the CGI department.
Right.
So I would say for very little kids, I would stay away from this. But I brought Nick, and he's 9, and he has read enough and seen enough that has the Merlin and Morgana mythology in it that he was really excited, including the Magic Treehouse books and Trollhunters, the Guillermo del Toro series on Netflix. Trollhunters has a whole, you know, a lot of Merlin and Morgana stuff. So if your kids like to read and they like that kind of adventure story, they might be into it from that regard.
Have you shown him Disney's The Sword and the Stone?
I don't think I have.
Oh, my God.
What a bad parent I am.
You're the worst.
I'm taking him to Lego Movie 2 tonight, so he's very excited about that. And then last night, he and Chris went to the comic book store, and Chris got him a couple of, they now have, like, Miles Morales comic books. They have, like, Spider-Verse Miles Morales comic books.
Well, I think, I mean, they've had them for a while.
But these are like new ones post-film.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Specifically tied into, oh,
okay. It's come full circle and
well,
all that stuff.
Yeah, no, like Marvel's no dummy about that kind of stuff. Like, they're like, oh, you like this in a movie? Here's 10 titles with these characters.
Get that merch out to those kids with the extra cash from lawn mowing or whatever it is. So,
but yeah, for a January kids movie, this is a lot more fun than you might think it is.
I agree. So I'm saying 7.
I said 6.5. It's, you know, I think there are moments that don't quite gel in the way you want it, but overall, I had a good time, and I, you know, I am amazed that it's taken this long for Cornish to get a second film directed. Because
2011 was it?
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, because it, I mean, Attack the Block wasn't a hit, but I think it's become a film that people talk about a lot. It's the movie where John Boyega was kind of discovered. So, yeah. I don't know what that's about, but anyway, he's back. Check it out.
Yes, it's at 87% on the tomato meter, so The Kid Who Would Be King. Go see it.
Yeah.
We're talking about TV now.
Yes.
It's your TV dinner version of Breakfast All Day.
There you go.
Christy and Alonzo are still here, and we're going back to True Detective, episodes 2 and 3 of this new third series,
season,
because I'm a dumbass. I didn't watch the second episode. When they aired the second episode after the first episode, I didn't realize it was there. So I've now since played catch up. And then there was a third one on Sunday.
Right. So now we're caught up.
We're all caught up.
Today.
We're here for you. So okay. Alonzo, please tell us about episode 2 is Kiss Tomorrow Goodbye, directed by Jeremy Saulnier. Episode 3 is The Big Never, directed by Daniel Sackheim.
Yes. So, you know, we're obviously getting deeper into the case, but obviously, you know, over the 3 timelines. But the big move forward is that in the 1990 timeline, they have found fingerprints for adult Julie at the Walgreens that has been broken into by presumably people who were stealing drugs. So she's alive, and there's a question of whether or not she is a drug addict and criminal. You know, the 2015, Wayne is clearly still dealing with memory issues, and they seem to be sort of dancing around the notion of him having Alzheimer's, but no one wants to say the word. But he is, you know, he's finding himself in strange places, but he knows that he's going to those strange places for a reason. He just can't remember what that reason is.
Right. That last image of the end of episode 2 is quite chilling, where in the middle of the night, he finds himself in his bathrobe and like boxer shorts and a t-shirt at that intersection where the house was.
Yes.
And he doesn't quite know why he's there. Yeah. There's still like, there's some integrity there to him. There's some pull that he's trying to understand, which has got to be enormously frustrating to somebody who was so meticulous with details for so long.
Right. So I think, yeah, we're dealing with this sort of like, you know, yeah, it's a detective story where our chief conduit into it is eventually somebody who's dealing with memory loss. Mm-hmm. And so it just be, you know, an already complicated mystery is complicated even further by the fact that the there's this lack of mental acuity and ability to sort of remember clues and sort through them.
It puts everything into question across all 3 timelines.
Exactly. Yeah. And so, you know, we find out that like, you know, in 1990, you know, Roland has continued to like get promotions and to succeed as a lawman, and has been trying to kind of bring Wayne with him and being told not to. So over and over again, I think we're, like I said, we're, the recurring motif here is this notion of being a black cop in a white power structure, and what that looks like, and how you get treated, and how you get treated by, you know, like potentially friendly witnesses, even, you know, do they want to talk to Stephen Dorff? Do they don't want to? Because they don't want to talk to they want to talk to Roland. They don't want to talk to Wayne. You know, meanwhile, like we see more of the relationship with Amelia, where she is kind of, you know, having written the book, sort of gives her this. It's like the thing they've always had in common is this case. It's how they met. You know, it is, you know, she writes the book about it, and he's in the book, which he feels uncomfortable reading. You know, she goes to sort of like use her feminine wiles on these cops in another town to find out about more information about the fingerprints, and he gets very resentful about that. We also learn in 1990 that Tom has stopped drinking and has found religion.
That's Scoot McNairy's character.
Right.
And the dad.
And he's open to having the investigation reopened, you know, if it means they can hopefully track down where Julie is. We find out that the kids were lying about where they were going. So what's that about? They were off playing in some deserted area where people kept seeing a sedan. We find out that the cops weren't really following up on the whole sedan thing, even though a lot of different witnesses pointed it out to them. This brown car with a black man with a scar and a white woman. That's what we know.
Yeah, more little clues. There are little pieces of paper that show up.
Oh, right,
with little scribblings on them in precise, what is clearly adult handwriting.
Yeah.
Reassuring notions saying, like, it's okay, don't listen to them, I'm here for you, things like that. And so you begin to wonder, was their disappearance a random thing that just happened that day, or were they being groomed to be lured away?
Right. The boy was clearly inventing some kind of Dungeons and Dragons-ish game. You see, like, you know, he finds, like, the multi-sided dice in the woods. And
which makes sense for that period in time, 1980.
That whole satanic panic thing, too, you know, where it's like, yeah, not only was there D&D, but there was, you know, it's funny because Dave is reading this book called Why Should the Devil Get All the Good Music, and it's about that whole kind of, at least partially about the sort of satanic panic craze of the early 80s where, you know, you had these Christian pundits talking about heavy metal and role-playing games and all these things that were going to drag their kids into Satanism and devil worship and blah, blah, blah. So I could see we might be going there, this being Arkansas. And then, we find out that the child's death pose mirrors his first communion picture.
Oh.
Are Catholics the only ones who do First Communion?
I don't know. Maybe Episcopalians do? I don't know.
Yeah.
Did you get baptized and confirmed and all that?
Oh, yeah. I was Catholic. So, yeah. I was baptized, First Communion and confirmation.
Same. And we turned out fine.
Yeah. But, no, I was curious about that because, like, the Scoot McNairy family did not strike me as Catholic, but Episcopal might work.
Yeah.
Anyway, I don't know how that stuff works.
So what's a couple of intriguing things here is you find out more and more about Amelia, about Carmen Ishogo's character, mm-hmm. who at first seems like a really sweet school teacher mm-hmm. who, you know, has some ambitions of getting out of this town and doing something else besides teaching school in small town Arkansas. She and Wayne get to know each other a bit, she starts talking in kind of vague terms about her Black Panther past
right.
in the 70s in San Francisco and what
protesting the war.
Things happened that were not good is how she phrases it in a vague way as they're kind of flirting with each other and feeling each other out.
Again, while on a, like, you know, missing child search in a state park.
Yeah.
Like, their entire relationship is tied into this case.
They're just kind of chatting, kind of passing the time, kind of getting to know each other. Of course we know that they're going to go on and they're going to get married. There are adult children who are in the 2015 timeline, so we know about all this. But she's kind of fascinating in the really subtle ways that she does and does not say things.
Right.
And it's kind of tantalizing. And it's an interesting contrast with Mahershala Ali's character who, while he's distinct in all three timelines, in 1980, 1990, and 2015, he seems rather straightforward, right? Even like the memory loss is a straightforward, seemingly simple thing, whereas she's playing a game. She's kind of beguiling, you know, and he's the one who just seems to be focused on the work and doing the right thing and doesn't seem to have secrets, and she perhaps might.
Yeah. There's that whole segment also where he takes the kids to Walmart.
Oh, gosh.
And loses the daughter. And it's like, you know, I mean, first of all, Ace's job on recreating a 1990 Walmart in Arkansas, but also the notion that, like, if you are dealing with, like, missing, murdered children all the time in your job, and then you become a parent yourself, mm-hmm. like, how protective you probably are and how easy it is for you to go to the worst place, you know, when the second one of your kids is just out of your eyesight for however long.
I am probably a bad mom in that regard because, like, I'll go to Costco with Nick, or Chris and I will go to Costco with Nick, and we'll just let him play on the iPad while we shop at Costco.
Like in the car?
No. Like in the iPad section of Costco.
Oh.
You know how they have, like,
a
bunch of computers and phones and tablets. And so he would never go off with anybody. He would never be lured away from anybody. And he's just so focused on that, like, he's not going to go wandering around. He's 9 and a half. He's not going to go wandering randomly. We know we can go back and he'll be exactly there.
Right.
So I'm maybe bad in that regard. Like, I'm not protective enough, perhaps.
I don't know. I mean, I'm not a parent, so it's not my, I got no dog in this hunt, but I think I sort of see both sides of it. I think that there is an alarmism that is kind of created by the media in a lot of ways where I think kids are allowed a certain degree of agency. Like, remember there was that thing a few years ago where the woman in New York where her kid wanted to, like, go home by himself and they, like,
set on the subway.
Up, yeah, and they set up this whole thing, like, all right, we're gonna part ways here and then you're going to do da-da-da-da. And then, like, all these people got mad at her about it and, you know, flipped out. And I think, like, no, I think maybe there is such a thing as being too overprotective. But at the same time, like, you watch something like this or, you know, a documentary like, oh, God, what is that? It was Slam Dance a couple of years ago. It was about a missing child, and it sort of delves into the notion of there are these, as this show kind of suggests, these sort of networks of I think it's called, like, What Happened to Johnny? Mm-hmm. These networks of pedophiles, you know, who do seek out these kids who are, you know, vulnerable and you know, and so, yeah, I can't imagine trying to make those decisions.
Yes. No, I did definitely feel the panic of Mahershala Ali's character when he's like, he can't find his daughter at Walmart. Like, yeah. We've all had that. So, I want to get into a theory, if I may. And please only watch this. Did you read the story I sent you?
I haven't, but okay. You can give me the TLDR.
Okay. Right? So, there's a story in Vulture. There's a theory posited in Vulture about this. And please only listen and or watch this part if you have seen episode 3.
Well, I think by this point they better have.
Just making sure. I'm just my caveat to you all here. So the theory is that Amelia is the killer.
Wow.
That Amelia wanted to make a name for herself with, like, a true crime novel.
Uh-huh. Oh,
and
so
how
she...
better to do it than to actually be the killer.
And to know stuff.
So she knows stuff, and then she also knows stuff from the investigative perspective because she's involved with the lead investigator. And that you see examples of how she's really good with kids. Uh-huh. You know, and there's a kid at the school that the police are trying to question about a friend of
the kid
of
with
the
puppy who they were allegedly going to go play.
Right, the friend of the Purcell kids, and he wasn't talking to anybody. Mm. And then Amelia sits down with him and is just kind and warm, and she gets him to talk. And they comment on that, like, "Wow, he hasn't been talking to anybody. You have a really great way with kids." And so that suggests that perhaps she has the ability to, you know, lure kids away to make him feel safe, make him feel loved, and then perhaps go in for the kill. That's part of it. And then there's also
what happened to Julie?
Right.
If she's the perp, then who took Julie away?
The story also comments on the slight kind of flinch that Amelia has when Wayne comes home and tells her in the 1990 timeline Julie's alive. Her face is not one of, like, oh, my God, really? She's not excited.
Right.
Her face is like, oh. Like, it's almost pained or scared or, like, panicked slightly at the notion that this person got away. Mm. The car, the nice brown sedan
might
be the same kind of car that we see at the beginning of episode 1 when Wayne and Amelia are talking and a guy calls out to her that seems to be her boyfriend and then she hops in the car with him. That might be the same kind of car. So is it possibly that it was a black woman and a white man, not a black man and a white woman?
Maybe.
So that's the theory that Amelia is actually the killer.
Well, after Westworld season 1, I've decided to stop reading these theories because, like, everybody was right about Westworld season 1 to ruin the whole thing.
So I guess, is it fun then to think about that and look for clues to that regard or just to go into it and enjoy the ride? I don't know. But I've just blown it for you, so you're welcome.
I'll keep an eye on that and we'll see.
But, yes, you know. Anyway. So once again, I'm, as always, blown away by the versatility of Mahershala Ali and his ability to make this character so distinct throughout these three different time periods.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, I think the whoever's doing hair, makeup, and costume has a lot to do with that for all the characters. But yeah, Ali really, you always, it's that thing where they don't have to tell you on screen when it is.
Yeah.
Like, you just watching him, you know, okay, this is this version of this guy.
And that's not just the hair or the clothes.
No, the way
he's carrying himself.
Absolutely. Yeah,
the old man makeup is excellent in this. I meant to mention that in the first episode we talked about, but it's so good.
Yeah.
it's so believable and doesn't look fake. It's so hard to pull off old man makeup well.
Yeah, I think. And I was trying to think of like what are examples of like good, like specifically black old man makeup. And it's like, I mean, the Eddie Murphy movies, I think it's a touch clumps. Exaggerated, you know.
Right, but that is also, if you'll recall, isn't that Academy Award nominated?
Rick Baker, winner.
For Norbert?
Norbit.
Norbit, right. Yeah. Did he win? Okay.
I think he did.
I don't remember.
Oscar winner Norbit.
Yes.
But obviously for any race, gender, whatever, it's hard to do without the high school play of like, you know, baby powder in the hair and lines on the forehead, you know. It's being done very well. My only thing about not thinking that it's Amelia is just that my takeaway from the first two seasons is that when they ultimately do reveal the killer, it's like either someone you've never seen before or some tertiary character, and it was never really about the whodunit. It was about the psyche of the detectives, right. You know. But maybe they've got
a different direction. The character exploration.
Exactly. Who knows? All right. Well, listen, thanks you guys for watching. Share your own theories in the comments. And we are on YouTube and we're also a podcast. So you can subscribe and leave us positive feedback at all the places, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, Stitcher, you name it. And you can follow us at BeFast All Day on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. And we're BeFast All Day Pod or Podcast at Gmail.
Pod.
We think it's BeFastAllDayPod@gmail.com, but
anyway,
if it bounces back, you'll know it wasn't. All right. Anyway, thanks you guys for watching. We'll be back next week with more new movies and more True Detective.
What's next week? What's coming out next week?
What is next week?
It's February 1st.
Woo.
That ain't a good sign.
Well, at least it's not January.
January's bad. Okay. Oh, I can tell you. I'm looking at the handy dandy film week list as we speak. So amazing movies like... Hang on. Arctic, which I have seen.
Okay.
That is Mads Mikkelsen is stranded in the snow.
Not to be confused with Polar, the new Netflix movie, also starring Mads Mikkelsen.
That's amazing. Miss Bala, a remake of Miss Bala is coming out with Gina Rodriguez.
Right.
And Then Came You, which is a romantic comedy about a hypochondriac.
Okay.
A young hypochondriac is befriended by a terminally ill British teen. That sounds all kinds of adorable.
Oh, brother.
And, Velvet Buzzsaw.
Oh, yes.
Which is supposed to be amazing.
Yeah, which is Tony Gilroy, right?
Yeah, it's premiering at Sundance. It's Jake Gyllenhaal and Rene Russo reuniting with Tony Gilroy. It's premiering at Sundance.
Going to Netflix.
And then opening, is it only Netflix?
Well, I might be getting some theatrical, but it's.
Anyway.
Wherever you are, you'll be able to see
it. Hopefully we can talk about that. They are screeners of that.
Oh, good deal.
We should talk about that. So good stuff is on the horizon, hopefully.
All right. Well, thanks you guys as always for listening/watching, and we'll see you next time.
Bye.